Hundreds of years ago, it seems now, I wrote a book called Prime Rib and Apple. This book is out of print. And often when my books go out of print, I put them back again with another publisher. This one I decided I wouldn't, even though it's been probably my second best-selling book. And in rereading it, which was an interesting thing, I never read my books once they're written, they're done. I was quite surprised at some of the good thoughts in it. Well, just to keep me humble, I shared this with the committee. I received a letter, and you know what I'm going to say. It was a very, very nice letter from a lady I've never met before, from a town, I don't know where it is, saying that, "Dear Mrs. Briscoe, knowing my love of books, God led me to a garage sale where I found yours." If you want to know how God keeps me humble, that's one way. I thought that was rather neat, though. Somebody had put all my books in her garage sale, and this lady found Prime Rib and Apple, which she took home, and it was a great help to her. So I thought that if you have any of Prime Rib, put them in your garage sale, and somebody might pick them up. As I picked it up and discovered what she had discovered, I thought, yes, I can use some of this material. So I'm going to be talking about the prime ribs of the Bible, starting with Eve. She was the prime rib, wasn't she? And the title of the book, Prime Rib and Apple, is obvious. We're going to be talking about Genesis 1, Genesis 2, and Genesis 3 today. The overarching title of these talks is Women Who Made a Difference, Women Who Changed Their World. And most of the women I'll be talking about will change their world for the good. I don't know if we can say that about Eve. She's probably the one that didn't make too much of a good difference to paradise. In fact, she made a difference negatively, didn't she? But then it was through Eve that the promised child, Jesus Christ, came. So she made a difference in the end. So we'll be in Genesis 1, Genesis 2, and Genesis 3 today, and that's quite an easy place to find. Now, let's think about Eve. I'm going to be talking about Eve's identity, Eve's industry, and Eve's image. And this will really be a talk about identity. About identity. Eve changed her world, and she made a difference for every daughter of Eve ever since Genesis 3, and will do to the end of time. The problem for Eve was she was having an identity crisis. Now, some of you shrug your shoulders and say, "Did I come here to hear that? What's new? My teenage daughter has one of those every morning at breakfast." She comes down with some wild hairdo that looks as though she's put her finger in the socket, and she's having an identity crisis. She's trying to identify with her group or with the in image. But when we really ask people, what is an identity? And why have a crisis about it? It's rather hard to define, and that's where we have to start. First of all, we need to ask, what is an identity? The dictionary definition of identity says the condition of being the same as someone or something, or to join or closely associate with, to become the same as, to make an identification of oneself with someone else, to match, to combine in interest and purpose, to find someone somewhere that's going to complete me, make me feel, that's it, we're one. That's an identity. And we are told that today's woman is searching for her identity, looking for those eternal answers that man and woman have asked from the start of time. Who am I? Why am I? Where am I? And what am I supposed to be? And what am I supposed to be doing? I stopped on O'Hare and Detroit and New York and all over this week, and I just stood in front of the newsstands. And I decided not to waste my money bringing 30 magazines to you. But if you're wondering where a woman is looking at her identity and for her identity, then just do the same thing that I did. And this is where women are fascinated. They are trying to find, apparently, something that they can identify with. And so they're buying this material. They have a fascination with the lifestyle of the rich and famous, otherwise these magazines would be purporting to show us something else. models women are looking for a model to match themselves to, or to find someone like them that matches their identity. That's why the soaps apparently are so popular, so the researchers say. Women find someone in those soaps to attach themselves to live in their lives, to feel what it's like, to solve the problems with them. So movies, TV, novels. And if it isn't in this area, they look to marriage. This idea of two becoming one flesh, it's a search for identity. If I can find a partner where I can totally identify myself with someone to become the same as, maybe that's where I'll find my satisfaction. So marriage sometimes becomes an end in itself. When a woman says, my identity is in my marriage partner, that is very true for some women. And that's why they get into very serious trouble when the man leaves, divorces, or death happens. I was speaking to a pastor's wife this last conference I've just been to, and she said, my identity is in my husband. Certainly in the eyes of other people, I am called the pastor's wife. She said the garbage collector's wife is not named so. Hello, this is the garbage collector's wife. Nor is the grocery man. This is the grocery man's wife at a party. This isn't the doctor's wife or the dentist's wife or the engineer's wife. This is Mrs. Whoever. But I am always the pastor's wife. And she said, I feel that I'm only important or significant in that role. People don't look at me as me. My worth is dependent on being the pastor's wife. Help me. So often in marriage, your identity can be wrapped up with that other person to such a degree that sometimes you sit down and say, am I significant at all? What would happen if my husband wasn't there? Do people look at me, and do I have worth in their eyes because I'm married to him? Now, of course, this is a problem, or if your identity is wrapped up in your children, it's the same sort of problem. What happens when they go to school? Suddenly, the whole of your worth has been wrapped up in their achievements. Who are you? Is there life for you? Is there identity for you in such a stage of life? Otherwise, people look for their identity in modern philosophy. In the 50s, Betty Friedan came along and said, the problem for women today isn't sexual, but a problem of identity. She put her finger on the problem. She said, the thing is, and this was her idea, that a woman's identity wasn't necessarily found in a man or marriage or having a child, but in self-fulfillment. Your identity is in yourself. Forget about everybody else. Forget about bigger and greater beings outside yourself. Identify with who you are. That's where the answer is. Do what you want, how you want, no matter how it affects anybody around you. And so many, many women walked away from marriage into perhaps a career and threw their identity into a career. I'm very interested to read some of Betty Friedan's writings now and see that she is a lot more honest than a lot of people in being able to say they came up empty. We came up empty. Because God never intended a woman's identity to be found in herself alone. Then Shirley MacLaine came along and a whole lot of New Age philosophies, and she said, that's not quite right. You find your identity when you identify with the environment, with Mother Earth, with the unseen, with the living cosmos. God is in all of these things, and I am God, and when I identify with the God in the cosmos, then I will find my fulfillment. There I will find a reason for being. And yet God did not make man the same as Mother Earth, to identify totally, to be the same, to find his and her identity in the cosmos and in the objects around us. And so again, people are coming up empty. And the Christian would definitely say, without equivocation, we believe we have an answer to this identity crisis. We believe you find your identity in the God who created you, in a God who gave you an identity like his. And if you turn to Genesis 1, verse 26, You'll see the reason that Christians believe this. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man, male and female, in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth, subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Notice he didn't say become one with. He said rule over the animals and the cosmos to be a vice regent, a viceroy of my creation. And so the identity that we're going to be talking about is an identity that was to be found as Adam and Eve, and we're thinking of Eve particularly, as Eve identified with the God who was her creator. She his creature, he her creator. And in this would lay her reason for being and would give her total fulfillment and a sense of value and significance and importance. Eve would discover her true self and her true joy as she nurtured and enjoyed this close relationship with the one who'd made her for his pleasure. What is it that we are taught in our creedal confessions? The whole duty of man is to serve God and enjoy him forever. Little boy, trying to write that out, said the whole duty of man was to serve God and endure him forever. And I assure you, that is not the idea of the Creator. For he made male and female to enjoy him. He put them in paradise, and paradise is not a place where you live with a long face. So we, as the daughters of Eve, may be searching for our identity, may have been searching for identity all our lives. And if we've been looking in the wrong place, we will still come up empty. Now, some of you that are here and don't agree with me even at this point may say, "Now, wait a minute, I do find a fulfillment in who I am and what I'm doing. And it really isn't in my relationship with God." I would have to say I feel fulfilled as a wife, as a mom, as a business person, as a person, as I am. I don't feel I've lost my identity in something or some other person. So I don't agree with you. I don't think that fulfillment is to be found in God alone or in God first. Well, might I suggest if you found fulfillment in all these good things, that's tremendous. But I would definitely, as a Christian, have to say to you, wouldn't you like it to be better? There is an element in a relationship with God that if you have never really experienced it, you cannot possibly talk with authority about. And once somebody that feels fulfilled now finds a relationship with God, they realize that they were never fulfilled at all. And so it isn't just the woman who feels empty or searching that I'm talking to. I'm talking to the woman who feels full but just doesn't know how full she could really be when she finds her true identity in the God who created her to find her true, full, fullest satisfaction in a relationship with her Creator. So Eve's identity crisis is ours. And I see it all around, and I hear it day after day as I speak to women and they speak to me. And the Bible is really a story of man, male and female's identity, revealed in creation, obscured in the fall, and renewed in redemption. And that's what I'm going to be talking about in the rest of this study. The Bible is the story of man, male and female's identity, revealed in creation, as it should be, obscured in the fall, and renewed in redemption. And so we are going to be in Genesis 1, in Genesis 2, and in Genesis 3, where these things are talked about. Now, obviously, they're talked about in the whole of the Bible, but this is where we'll be studying Eve at this point. Eve's industry, Eve's work. In Genesis 1, we've read about her being created and being told to do the job that God created her to do. And with a perfect sense of her own identity, we come into Genesis 2 at this point. She was given a job to do with Adam. They were to be God's lords over creation, both of them. It stemmed from his image that they bore, for he was the Lord of all creation, and they were made after his image, after his identity. So Eve, in Genesis 2, had no problem feeling significant and important and of value with such meaningful occupation. She was given a job to do and never felt she had to shop around to find a better one. She loved her work, in other words. And she found this a significant ground for being. He had created her with an intelligent and significant reason in mind. To be a farmer's wife, if you like. What do you say? Really? She found value in that. Well, it was a whole lot more than being a farmer's wife. But it was paradise to wake up on Monday morning. How about that? Paradise to wake up on Monday morning. That's how fulfilled she felt about the job that God had designed her to do as her creator. Her industry was a personal joy. He had designed her to match her designed work. I counted not two or three, but many magazines that are being aimed at the woman who is dissatisfied with her work, with her place. How to change a job, how to write a resume. Because women are looking for a match-up in this sense, that this isn't really or can't be the job that God wants me to do or has designed me to do because I'm dissatisfied. What on earth am I doing? What on earth am I supposed to be doing? How does this work I am doing match up with the way that I'm made? And that is, quite honestly, a very practical reason that a lot of women aren't satisfied. God has designed them, certain people, to do certain jobs, and they're in the wrong niche. They're square pegs in round holes, perhaps. And that's the reason they're dissatisfied. Job satisfaction is rampant. But I believe that God designed us to be the person we are to do the job he designed us to do. He designed our bodies to do it in. Jesus had not ever had an identity problem. He said, "A body hast thou prepared for me. Lo, I come to do thy will, O my God." Now that's it. If you want to know what a true sense of fulfilled identity is, look at that statement. Jesus said, "A body hast thou prepared for me. A perfect body to do the job you've called me to do." It was a Jewish body. That was a perfect body to do the job of redemption that Jesus had been called to do. He did not prepare a Jewish body for you. He prepared an American body or a British body or whatever it is, because he has a perfect designed purpose for you and for me. And the body he gave us is part of that. Our bodies match the purpose that God has designed for them. And we won't have an identity crisis when we realize that all that we are as a person matches all he's planned for us to do, where he wants us to do it specifically. And that involves our mind. We are neither brighter than we should be or dumber than we should be. We are just right. For God has programmed into us our intelligence level, our ability level, our emotional level, and even our background and environment, spoiled, maybe damaged though it might be, is part of what God planned for us. And he wants it all to come together. And if you've never come by Christ to God and don't have a significant personal relationship with him, you won't fully know who you are, and you won't fully know what you're supposed to be doing. And therefore, you won't feel as significant as you could feel and be. In other words, if you don't believe God has created you for a purpose, you won't believe God wants to match what he designed you to be with what he designed you to do. And when you commit, when you search for that, when you find it, then you'll find that doing what he designed you to do, being obedient to that, helps you to wake up every Monday morning saying, "Monday morning is paradise." For the reason for Eve's creation obscured in the fall was renewed in redemption. And knowing God brings all that together. I was sitting on an aeroplane going to Detroit to speak to 350 Missouri Synod Lutheran ladies, leaders across the nation. Now, why was that paradise? Why did I say, "I love what I'm doing"? Isn't this fun? Isn't this terrific? Because God designed us in a certain way. And as I began to think about that, I began to get so excited, and I've been excited all week, because I love all the things that I do. I love to teach, because that's what God designed me to do. When I was a little girl, I never played house. I put all my dolls in lines and bossed them around. Because God designed me that way. I love to write. It's a discipline. It's a very hard discipline. But I would have to say, I really do love it. I love the ideas. And God designed me to do that. I love to be creative. That's why I love to write plays and I love to make things, create things. I love to be a mom and a grandmom, and I love to be a wife because God designed me to be a wife and a mom and a grandmother. I love to be married to the man I'm married to. I don't know if I'd love being a wife of anybody else's, but I sure love being Stuart's wife because I believe he designed me to be Stuart's wife. And I'd rather have a little bit of him than a lot of anyone else. That's what Billy Graham's wife said. I love being a leader because that's what God designed me to do. And a motivator. I love it all. I love being a speaker because God designed me to do a job. And in my relationship with him, I have been discovering all my life that it can be paradise on Monday mornings. Now, Eve felt this. The work was to receive what God wanted her to know of himself and his instructions and to be obedient to it. Her job also, apparently, was to reproduce children, to replenish the earth, and she was very good at that. They reckoned by 130 years later, there were millions of people on the earth. I don't think she'd done it all, but, you know, she'd done part of that. So her job was to receive, was to be a mom, was to be a wife, to reproduce, to be a mother, and to rule with Adam, to receive as God's choice partnership the rule over creation. She was fully equipped to receive God's blessings and instructions. And she went about and did it and thoroughly enjoyed it. And that's what Genesis 2 is all about. She was called Adam's helper. And through this little talk, I'm going to give you two sides of the argument here because the whole Christian world is split into two. There is people that believe helper means one thing and people that believe helper means another. And I'm going to tell you what they both believe. And then it's up to you to wrestle, as everybody else is wrestling, with where you come down. But helper to one set of people in the Christian world means an ideal partner, parallel to, suitable for, equal to. They get this, and I would tend to agree with them here. If you want to know where I am, I'll tell you. That's fine. Because 21 times in the Old Testament, it's used as God helping Israel. The word is used, God holpens Israel or helps Israel. God is the helper of Israel, and that's the word that's used here. It's only used twice in the other sense as a helper inferior to, like a servant to his master. So I would tend to take this point of view that in Genesis 1 and 2, God's plan in creation was to have egalitarian relationship between Adam and Eve, equal partners, ideal partners. Somebody has said that Eve was not taken from his head to rule over him or his foot to be trampled underfoot by, but from his side as his partner. When Adam saw her, he exclaimed, "Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh." And McNally says, what he's really saying is, "This is me. This is me." It was a cry expressing common nature and identity. God created man, male and female man, in his image. Now, some would take another view. They would say that Adam named Eve. Therefore, this shows that he was superior over her because he had priority to her. He came along first. And actually, Paul uses this argument in 1 Corinthians 11:9. But Paul uses it in another context. And when we're talking about Genesis, you have to say, well, that might be a point. Maybe if Adam was created first, it means he was to be superior or first, and Eve was created second, and that means that woman is to be second. I don't think that argument holds up because Adam was created second to the animals. And I don't think he was supposed to be submissive to the animals. But people that take this view say Woman was not made for herself, but to complete the man. In fact, Paul says, man was made first, and then Eve was made second, and Eve was made for Adam. Adam was not made for Eve. But then he balances it immediately in the next verses by saying, but then, even though woman was not made for herself, but for Adam, neither is the man independent of the woman and needs to be submissive to her. So he balances the statement out in his argument there. But there's a lot of problems here. Did God make Adam and Eve equal? And I believe that Genesis 1 gives us an incredible statement, a powerful statement of equality, and Genesis 2 as well. If headship is seen in Genesis 2, and at best I think it is implied, if it is there, I believe true headship was to ensure a complementary partnership of equals. That Adam's job was to make sure that the woman reached her full potential as his equal partner, and that he was responsible as the head of the woman to do that. He was responsible to bring Eve to an equal state of function along his side. And that's what true headship should be about. Now, Eve's identity in God and Eve's industry for God with Adam in harmony and equality was about to be shattered. And when we come into Genesis 3, we see that Eve's identity is obscured in the fall. We look at Eve's image. What does it mean, image? Well, it means a resemblance to an archetype. It's a reflection, a mirror, a representation. A shadow is an image. Man was meant to be the shadow of the statue. The statue was God, if you like, and man was the shadow of the statue. Man was never meant to live independently of God. How can a shadow live independently of a statue? And that was the subtlety of the snake, suggesting to Eve that this was possible. The shadow can live without the substance, he said. The shadow can live all by itself, without the sustaining power of the statue. How silly, how stupid. But she bought it, and we'll see why in a minute. But the definition of an image is the archetype or the statue or the real thing, images or mirrors, like a shadow, or like the express image of a coin. You know, if a man wore a ring and he pressed it on a piece of wax, the express image of the ring would come into the wax. Now, we are not quite like that. That's a picture, but it falls down. Christ is the express image of God because he is God. He's the exact representation of God. And Colossians 1 verse 15 tells us that. The invisible Christ is a visible representation, a manifestation of God himself, two created beings. Hebrews 1 3. Christ is the image of his substance. He is more than a shadow. He is the express image of God himself. And we are not like God. We are not imaged in God in the sense that Christ is, because Christ is God and we are not. Then how are we like God? What does it mean that man is in the image of God? How are we after his likeness? How do we have a resemblance to God? Well, in other senses, we are a personal, rational, moral being like him. In that way, we carry his image. We are like the Trinity. We are like the triune God in the sense of our plurality. Something of the plurality of God will be reflected in his image bearers. The man that God created comes as male and female. Plurality. So in this sense, in our maleness and our femaleness, together in harmony, not competitiveness, in companionness, men with women, not just marriage I'm talking about now. God intended in creation, he intended it to be that we mirrored the triune God in the sense of plurality. Man that God created comes as a plurality, as male and female. In this sense, we both, male and female, reflect his image. In other words, the image found in the relationship between the male and female should be like that, mirroring the relationship between the Trinity and unity and harmony and community. God created male and female to bear that likeness, not in a bodily form, not in maleness or femaleness, because God is neither male nor female. He transcends both. He uses maleness and femaleness as pictures of his character. I hope this isn't all too hard. I think it's fascinating, because it's lifting us, it's showing us that we, in our identity, we, in the fact that we've been created after the image of God, transcend the animals, certainly transcend the earth. And if we have an answer to the New Age philosophies, it is this. Not only are human beings superior to Mother Earth, human beings are very vastly superior to the animals. For the image of God is not found in the animals. They do not reflect his image. They reflect his genius, yes, but they do not reflect his image. They reflect his genius, but they do not reflect his image. Our bodies share a common dust origin with the animals, but our souls make the difference. Our souls make the difference. So the thing that sets men and women apart from animals and all other created beings is personality, is our mental and moral attributes that the animals do not share. For example, rationality, a self-conscious rationality that's able to reason. Who am I? It's able to grapple with the things I'm giving you. You're sitting there trying to follow, and I'm probably confusing you. But you're reasoning, aren't you? You're bringing other things to bear and saying, now, wait a minute, what about this? And this is a balancing factor. The reasoning capabilities of the mind of man is something totally unique to him. The will, you are a personal agent capable of self-determination. I see it in my little grandchild. I'm trying to help him get dressed. I can do it myself. I can do it myself. I can do it myself. They start when they're two, don't they? They are a personal agent capable of self-determination. I can do it myself. Responsibility, able to be obedient to a moral law. Now, that's what makes us different from the animals. I had a little boy that didn't want to go to Sunday school, and he was asked why, and he said, well, I just don't want to go. And his mother said, but you've got to learn to be a good little boy. And he said, I already know how to be better than I want to be. I love it. I already know how to be better than I want to be. So why go to Sunday school and learn something I don't want to learn? Now, this was a very bright little boy. What was he showing? Even as a little tiny boy, he was showing reasoning abilities. He was bringing to bear all sorts of things that he felt very deeply about. He had a will, or a won't, and that was obvious. And he also had this ability to be obedient or disobedient to a moral law. He already knew how to be better than he wanted to be. And yet, even that little boy knew there was a better to be. How did he know there was a better to be? Because human beings are made with a conscience that tells them there is a best, and they better be it. In England, we used to stand in lines in the war. And even today, I still join a line. I remember joining a line for bananas. I never had one, of course, during the war, and I'd never tasted one. I was 9 years of age before bananas came back to our country. And I remember standing for 2.5 hours in a queue, we call it, you call it a line. We queued for everything. We queued through the war, we queued after the war, and even now if I see a line, I just join it automatically because it's designed into me. That's part of my background. And you know, if anybody ever stood out of the line, if anybody ever came out of the queue and walked up to the front, the entire line would devour them, right? Still happens today. There is something in us. Now, why? Who said? What are you appealing to? You are appealing to a higher moral law. That's not fair. What's not fair? Who said it isn't fair? You know it isn't fair. You know it isn't right. How do you know it isn't right? Because you're made in the image of God. And he has stamped you with his image, which is a personal, rational, willful, moral image. And in that sense, we bear his likeness. Now, Eve knew all of this. He was the image maker. She bore his image, but she became the image breaker. She had such an identity crisis that she became the world's first iconoclast, which means identity wrecker. No more close associations with the one who created her. Independence was the way. Now, I want to say a word for Eve here. Out of good motives, she fell. What was wrong with wanting the good? And what was wrong with wanting the pleasurable, saying paradise was made up of it? And what was wrong with wanting to be wise? Nothing. nothing at all in this lay her deception and the subtlety of the snake. The good, the pleasurable, the wise, nothing wrong. The deceiving into that thinking came when the snake said, you can have these good, noble things independently of God. The shadow can live without the substance. In this lay her deception. And the image was broken. Now, let me say something here. It's very important to realize that Eve was deceived. That Eve was deceived. She is not the deceiver. Now, please, if you don't hear anything else, hear that. Eve was deceived. She was not the deceiver. Genesis 3, 1 to 13, you can read all about it. I'm sure you know the passage. We don't have time to read the passage. You go home and read it. Eve did not sin willfully, Gilbert Azekin says. She was fooled into making a fateful error of judgment. Then why was she deceived? Well, she was out of her league. She didn't know, perhaps, all that Adam knew, and I believe this, as I've studied it extensively, she was not privy to the knowledge that he had. She was privy to some of it. We don't know how much Adam had told her. We don't know if God directly had told her what he told Adam. The inference, certainly through Paul, is that she didn't know it all, that she was not privy to all the knowledge that he was knowledgeable about, and that's why the snake went for her, because he thought he had a better chance. She was deceived. She was tricked. God held Adam responsible, because I believe he held him responsible for keeping that perfect equation in Genesis 1 and 2. He held Adam responsible for the fall of the race, not Eve. As in Adam all die, not as in Eve. Romans 5, 12 to 14, sin entered the world through one man, Adam, and death through sin. In this way, death came to all men because all have sinned. Adam sinned by breaking a command with his eyes wide open. Eve was deceived. As in Adam all die, so in Christ will all be made alive. It doesn't say as in Eve all die. Now, why am I making such a point of this? Because it is terribly, terribly important. John Stott says, as a result of the fall, headship is degenerated into domination, subjugation, and blame. Women are covered in many countries of our world today. Why? Because the men regard them as the deceiver, not the deceived. As the deceiver and not the deceived. Women are deceivers. Women will create lust in us. A woman caused Adam to sin. Women will cause us, sons of Adam, to sin. And out of this has come history after history of terrible, terrible mistreatment to women. Aristotle said women are a kind of mutilated male. Calvin said women are an appendage to men. Luther said if a woman becomes dead through childbearing, it matters not, she's there to do it. And even in the church, the idea that woman is the deceiver and that God has prescribed for her punishment fitting in the sense of subjugation and mistreatment has filtered down. And here again, you get your evangelical world divided down the middle. Because many say the passage where God leans out of heaven and says, your desire will be to your husband and he shall rule over you, is descriptive, and many say it is prescriptive. Now, just put those two words down and think about them and get the books and read it for yourself. If it is descriptive of what would happen, then God was looking down the ages saying, now you've done it. Now you've done it. Man will subjugate, dominate, ill-treat. He will rule over you in the sense of letting the headship I had in mind degenerate into domination of the worst sort. If it is descriptive of what would happen because of the fall, then she, Eve, would desire her husband, would look to him. And one commentator has said this, and I'll just quote it. She would long to perpetuate the intimacy that characterized her and Adam's relationship in paradise, lost. But her nostalgia for the relationship of love and mutuality that existed before the fall would not be met. Then both desired each other. It would not be reciprocated after the fall by the husband. Instead, there would be no mutual support, no nurture, no family, no environment. He would rule over her in a negative sense. Some say, half the Christian world says, this passage is descriptive of what would happen to man and woman's relationships. Others say it was prescriptive, that God intended woman to be under man because of the fall, and his idea would be to rule over her in a good sense, that this is God's prescription for men and women after the fall. Both draw their reasons from the scriptures. Whether one is right or whether another is right, we must end this study by saying that Eve was promised deliverance, and woman's identity perfectly revealed in creation in Genesis 1 and 2, obscured in the fall in Genesis 3, is given a promise. Woman is given a promise. Your seed will bruise the serpent's head. The woman was not cursed, as some really believe women are a curse to men and treat them so today. Notice, in Genesis, God did not curse the woman, and God did not curse the man. God cursed the serpent, and God cursed the ground, but he did not curse man and woman. And God cursed Christ instead of cursing us. And it is in the curse of Christ on the cross that we find redemption can roll back the results of the fall. And I believe that redemption is meant to roll back the result of the fall. The result of the fall was the ground being cursed. What are we doing? We are trying to roll back the result of the fall. And we're trying to make it produce so that we can feed the world. What about the suffering that God said would come? Pain in childbirth. We are trying to roll back the curse of the fall and find answers to the suffering through medicine and healing ministries. What about the domination, wrongly, of man over woman? We should be trying to roll back the curse of the fall and restore, as much as possible, the identity and image of harmony between the sexes, equality and partnership, and a headship that is taught in the Bible that is responsible for seeing that that is done, responsible in the church, in the family, to see that the curse is rolled back in regard to men and women's relationships, and that we model, as nearly as we can, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. God renews in redemption what was lost in the fall. Now then, that's an awful lot to think about. But I believe that God promised a paradise that would be better even than the paradise that was lost. And in the redemption, the Christ, who was to be cursed for us instead of us being cursed because of the fall, in that redemption, the possibility of a heavenly paradise would be open to men and women, where such a thing could never happen again. And so did Eve change her world? Oh, yes, Eve changed her world. Did she change it for the better? You would have to say no and yes. She changed it for the worst by being deceived and falling and sinning. But through her, the seed of the woman, Christ, who is to be cursed for us, came. And in him, we can once more, by receiving him, have the image of God perfectly growing up in our lives, so that when God looks at us, he sees once again his image. And he prepares a paradise for us. In my book, Prime Rib and Apple, which you'll find in the garage sales, I use a creative license to talk about Eve. And we, daughters of Eve, I hope, can take something from the talk today and feel affirmed and significant and important, and realize that in the community of redemption, because of the new covenant, and now in Christ, there is neither male nor female, and barriers are to be done away. And in harmony and under responsible headship that makes sure that happens, in harmony in the church community, we are to model once more true imaging of God. In my attempt to capture this, I wrote this, and I'll finish with this, maybe on a lighter note. Omnipotence is the word I use for God, and prime rib is the word I'm using for Eve. Where did I go wrong, omnipotence? Eve asked. Why did I listen to the snake? How did he beguile me so easily? Omnipotence explained how the snake examines our lives for potential weaknesses and, having watched us carefully, approaches attacks and, if allowed to engage us in debate, finally achieves his black results. He watched you, prime rib, and saw three potential trouble spots in your character, and these he used. What were they? The little broken bone inquired. Prime rib loves to talk, Omnipotence explained. Now, I invented words, and they're a great idea as long as you don't overdo it. I thought of them so I could communicate with you. But you can't talk and listen at the same time, and therein lies the danger. I could see you'd never hear my warnings when all that noise was coming out of you. Talk, talk, talk. If it wasn't Adam, it was the animals. Didn't you notice the giraffe's neck was getting longer and longer, trying to get out of earshot? You should have been warned when the elephant's flap started to lie protectively over the holes in his head, instead of standing upright as I created them. You've been bending his ear, prime rib. How easy it was for the evil one's spirit to enter into one of your favorite animals and attract your attention. Even he found it difficult to get a word in edgewise, but when he did, you listened carelessly, not recognizing who it was that spoke to you. His subtlety is such that he would speak through such a lovely friend. I tried to argue, Prime Rib began. Omnipotence sternly answered, my angels dare not argue with or rebuke the snake. Then how do you suppose you can overcome? You should have refused to converse, rejected his proposals, referred him to me. You're no match alone. What else did I do wrong? The maness asked. You wanted too much, Omnipotence replied. But I had so much, said Prime Rib. Why did I long for more? The snake composed a tune to which you eventually danced, Omnipotence answered. It was this. Paradise isn't enough. Paradise isn't the best. You can have more than enough, but only I am offering you that. And to want more than I provide is to want too much. The too much only the snake can offer you is the too much of stepping out of the role for which I created you for. I made you a maness, not a goddess. I created you to cleave, not leave. You believed a lie. And then you ate too much, Omnipotence continued. I made you able to feel hungry, but I made you able to stay hungry too. The snake will tell you that a bite of disobedience will stay your hunger. That's a lie. My son will come to know the hunger of obedience. When offered bread, he'll choose to starve, for my goodwill shall his meat be. It should have been sufficient too for thee. It looks so tasty, said Prime Rib, but oh, how sick I am. The snake isn't stupid, Omnipotence replied. He will not offer you a rotten apple. But beautiful though it be, you should refuse, and in the doing find your satisfaction. Prime Rib wept for spoiled creation and the beasts, but most of all she wept for Adam. Omnipotence looked down the years and wept for her. He thought of Cain, the world's first murderer, of Abel's spilled blood, and of Prime Rib's broken heart. Then lifting his little man and maness into his everlasting arms, he showed them the end times when the snake would be forever chained in darkness. Pray for your offspring, little dust and bone people, he commanded. Pray hard, pray long, and tell them your story. But don't forget, in the telling, to tell them mine as well. Do you remember what it is? Knowing your rejection, I've planned for your redemption. And Prime Rib said, Omnipotence can do it. Omnipotence will do it. For omnipotence is omnipotence. And if you're looking for your identity today, it lies in him, in a relationship with him that affects every single relationship in your life. Let's pray. Oh God, we are all daughters of Eve. We would have done no better than she. Teach us, Lord, that you have revealed in creation where our identity should be, where our image is drawn from, and that in you and in you alone is fullness of life to be found. Teach us that you have industry, work for us to do, and that you have designed us and given us bodies to do it in. Perhaps some of us are a little suspicious of that. We're not quite sure if the body you gave us is really the best. And yet you have designed us uniquely with that in mind, that our abilities, our capabilities, our gifts, our talents, our very physical makeup, apart from anything else, has been programmed to meet a designed task. Like Eve, paradise will be found on Monday morning when we submit, finding out what that is and doing it. And Lord, thank you that even though the image of God was obscured in the fall, through redemption you intend the Church of Jesus Christ to roll back the effects of the fall in every way, and specifically in the relationship between the sexes. That men and women, whether married or single, may mirror in the community, the new community of believers, what you intended in the first place. Teach us how to do that. Teach us how to be true daughters of God as well as daughters of Eve. Sort it all out for us and help us to go away at least feeling incredibly significant, important, valuable, because you made us to be like that in relationship with you. And I would be remiss if I didn't give somebody an opportunity here that is wondering about how to have a relationship with God or how to start it, an opportunity just to perhaps say a simple prayer. Lord, I really would like a close relationship with you. I need to find my true identity in the God who made me. Be mine. Meet me. Match me. Come within my heart by your Spirit. Help me to feel I've come home. And give me a sense of incredible joy and excitement as I go on to know you better. Lord, hear all our prayers we pray for Christ's sake. Amen.